defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced the national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, Al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
Dr. Muhammad was sick.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees, as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Black flag was waved high on Tehran's sky in honor of a man who has inspired Muslims for more than 13 centuries, Imam Hussein. This symbolic ceremony marked the beginning of an annual tradition that commemorates the third Imam of Shia Muslims and mourns his tragic martyrdom at the hands of the cruel ruler of the time.
This is the fourth consecutive year that we at the Abbasabad Hills complex raised the symbolic flag of Imam Hussein over the city of Tehran to ring in the 10-day Muharram ceremonies. This is the tallest flagpole in the Middle East, measuring 150 meters in height, so it can be seen from many neighborhoods in Tehran.
Every year on Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary, Shia Muslims in Iran and across the world take part in mass mourning processions for 10 days, starting on the first day of the lunar month of Muharram. For the second year now, the ceremonies have been largely limited because of the coronavirus pandemic. Tehran City Council says it has restricted this year's ceremonies to open-air venues with smaller numbers of people.
We plan to hold a safe Muharram this year. Mourners are obliged to observe health protocols. Imam Hussein commemoration is a tradition that has been around for centuries, but what's important is the ideology of Imam Hussein that should be preserved, and our people need to be cautious and not hold the processions in large numbers.
Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were killed in Karbala in 680 AD after they refused to pay allegiance to then Umayyad ruler Yazid ibn Muawiyah. Islamic references have it that Yazid diverted Islam from the true version that was introduced by Prophet Muhammad. Being the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein tried to revive the true Islam by resisting against Yazid. For centuries, Imam Hussein has taught lessons of freedom to millions of people across generations through the annual commemoration ceremonies. This is the second year that mourning processions have been curtailed amid the coronavirus pandemic. But Muslims say his legacy is here to stay. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the official said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line, and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli-managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. The regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move. Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Starting almost a year ago as the first viable Iranian vaccine candidate, Coviran is now a household name in Iran. After passing all the clinical trials, Coviran launched its first production line 3 months ago and now has inaugurated the second line, which will more than quadruple the output capacity to roughly 15 million doses per month.
The second facility is larger than the first production line. It went operational today and will add some 8 million doses to the current capacity, getting the overall output to between 12 and 1 million doses a month. This will cover much of our domestic demand for vaccines.
With U.S. sanctions casting their shadow on the import of vaccines into Iran, the inoculation program has been slow in the country. The Delta variant has now swept across Iran, killing at least 400 people every day. Coviran says it is speeding up its efforts to produce as many jabs as possible to stem the tide of Delta, as they claim their vaccine can terminate the new variant.
There is a test called virus neutralization test, or VNT, which studies how much a vaccine can protect the body against a virus. The Delta variant has not yet proven to be vaccine evading, but based on VNT experiments conducted on Coviran, it can neutralize the Delta variant as well.
So far, Coviran has produced and administered 7 million doses. The biotech firm says it will launch a third production facility, which will add 10 million more doses each month, boosting the overall output to 25 million. Given a monthly domestic demand of less than 15 million, Coviran says the extra doses will be exported to other countries.
Coviran developers say their vaccine has so far covered 35% of the entire vaccination program in the country. They hope with the launching of the second production line here, the government will no longer need to rely on foreign jabs to inoculate its citizens. Yusuf Jalali from Coviran production facility in Alborz province.
Another episode in the British government's harsh immigration policy. A deportation flight planned for August 11th. On board, 19 people of Jamaican origins in this country for up to 30 years now.
The UK Home Office, responsible for immigration, has called those deportees foreign offenders, people who have come here and committed crimes and should expect to be removed.
But immigrant rights groups such as the Movement for Justice say the move is a reversal of an earlier agreement between the UK and Jamaican governments not to deport people who arrived in the UK as minors.
These are not people who should be deported. I deal very often with people who have lived in the country as children, or who have lived here for a very, very long time, or have been convicted of offences that aren't at the most serious end of the offences. So I have seen people for low-level drug dealing, not necessarily condoning it, but it is low-level drug dealing. There's all sorts of ideological and expert, you know, sort of, I suppose, societal issues, why that sometimes happens to people.
Some are believed to be relatives of the Windrush generation, citizens of the British Empire who traveled to Britain between 1948 and 1973. After the government called on its colonies to send workers to help rebuild the country after World War II.
They came in the 1950s, have really gotten the short end of the stick. And remember, their ancestors have already been through slavery and colonialism and neo-colonialism and governorships and all sorts of awful systems that has always put them as second-class citizens. Then they came here and they were treated as second-class citizens. We've seen that with the Windrush scandal. And it is their children and grandchildren who are now being shackled and put on those planes. It's, you know, a further... A further denigration of their rights.
Last year, 50 Britons of Jamaican descent were also forcibly removed. Many grew up in the UK. The hashtag Jamaica50 is still remembered.
People watching see the way that this government holds in such disrespect the contribution of West Indian, Caribbean, and black people in this country. When will black lives matter once again?
The British government claims the deportations are everything to do with public safety or protecting victims. But rights campaigners disagree. They say the move is purely racist and political, made by a failing government appealing desperately to its racist base. Saeed Fariza, London.
After the fall of four key provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan into the hands of Taliban, the militants are now planning to capture Badakhshan, one of the strategic and border provinces in the northeast of Afghanistan. Military commanders say the fall of some provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan makes the battle difficult for government troops in Badakhshan, but Afghan forces will do their best to push back Taliban attacks.
God willing, we as the commando troops promised the residents of Faizabad to protect them against the militants' attacks. We pushed back an overnight attack of the enemy on some entrances of the city. They have suffered heavy casualties and cannot launch another attack soon.
Apart from the risk of disruptive impacts of the surging conflict in Afghanistan, the number of displaced Afghans is rising day by day due to escalation of violence in their home provinces. Since most of displaced Afghans have no access to humanitarian aid, they have called on both the government and the UN to urgently address the need of tens of thousands of families who have been forced to flee their homes.
The recent rise in violence, mainly the collapse of some big cities in northern and southern Afghanistan, has badly damaged the lives of our people. All the collapsed cities are populated areas. Hundreds of thousands of people have so far been displaced while they have no shelter. The world must pay attention to Afghanistan now.
Currently, 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan are the scene of fierce battles between the Taliban and Afghan troops. The Taliban militants have captured four provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan since Sunday. The Afghan president recently said the situation will change in favor of Afghan national security and defense forces in 6 months. This is while Taliban says it's not willing to approve even a ceasefire. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Prisoners' Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Under the title, The Blockade and Raising Customs Tariffs is an American Crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Hadi government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden Port amid the continued closure of Hodeidah Port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders, militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities. And this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender. But our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
People here say that Washington is back in the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation in the brutal war on their country. Abulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Muharram special. Upon the arrival of the month of Muharram, the memory of Ashura uprising and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, becomes more vivid and heated in the hearts and minds of the free-spirited people of the world. The blood of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, which was shed innocently in the year 61 AH, runs fervently in ages and places in the vessels of millions of freedom-seeking and justice-seeking people throughout the world. Hussein, son of Ali, has become the prime symbol of struggle against tyranny and oppression. With the start of the mourning month of Muharram, the atmosphere of the Islamic Republic of Iran and many Islamic countries worldwide changes as cities and villages are black-clad. Placards and wall hangings are visible here and there, with the themes of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his unmatched uprising. The epic that the Holy Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, created in the year 61 AH has transcended history and geography as it breathes the spirit of human truth in everyone. The martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein is a reminder of his everlasting uprising in Karbala. Imam Hussein's asymmetrical battle against Yazid turned his steadfastness into a perpetual lesson for mankind in every age and every place. When the Imam saw injustice and corruption in the Muslim society, he understood that he had to stage an uprising against the status quo. He didn't resort to hypocritical and unequivocal methods in his course, and from the very beginning, he expressly announced that his aim was to enjoin what is good and forbid what is evil. He knew that the biggest and worst evil was the person of Yazid. The Epic of Ashura is a multidimensional phenomena which demonstrates beauties of Hussein in every dimension. One dimension is the valor of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, against the ruling oppressive system. Another dimension is his selflessness, which he manifested its climax by sacrificing his life and the lives of his relatives and companions, while knowing that after his martyrdom, the rest of his caravan, including his wife, sisters, children, nephews and nieces, would be captivated by the godless hordes of Yazid. Yet another dimension of his uprising is the fact that the Imam preferred dignity to humility, even at the cost of losing whatever he had. Still another dimension of the uprising is that Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, was a reformer who stood firmly on his sacred goal until his death. Maybe the most outstanding dimension of Imam Hussein's uprising is his faith in God and the Day of Judgment. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, manifested to mankind throughout history that dignity and nobility are of paramount importance and can never be sold as commodities. It is narrated in history that on their way to Karbala, Imam Hussein's caravan came across Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi, one of the top commanders of the enemy. Hor was the commander of over 1,000 horsemen. Hor blocked the Imam's way and wanted to besiege his caravan while his own forces were thirsty. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, told his companions, "Give water to these people." He ordered them to give water even to the horses of the enemy's forces. Imam Hussein, as the epitome of God's mercy, loved people and staged uprising for their salvation. The renowned scholar of the 20th century, martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, wrote, "The suffering and misery of the Prophet's enemies were very grave and painful for him. However, the enemies didn't understand this. The miseries of enemies were very grave for Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. He didn't want them to remain in wretchedness. Throughout his course, he was full of love and affection. He would speak to opponents in various junctures so that he might guide a single person. He said, 'Indeed, I am Hussein, son of Prophet's daughter Fatima and son of Ali. I am with you, and my family is with your family, and I am your role model.'" Lasting experiences of history indicate that a group of people follow the seekers of power and support falsehood, while another group, out of recognition and awareness, support the truth. These two groups have always been in conflict throughout history. Although false powers have succeeded from time to time to overcome truth and rule for a while, truth has never been destroyed, as it is genuine and has its roots in the system of creation. Truth and falsehood are like light and shadow. Light is genuine and everlasting, while shadow is transient. The battle of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and Yazid is the highest manifestation of the war between truth and falsehood. The month of Muharram is reminiscent of this battle for mankind.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
The term vaccine inequality has been used for developing countries who have not received appropriate jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. That has been one of the topics covered by Iran's leader in his most recent statements, in which he also slammed some foreign countries for failing to abide by their promises in providing vaccines, for example, to Iranians. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why vaccine distribution is not reaching many poor or developing countries and why vaccine inequality is persisting.
All the figures point to one fact. COVID-19 vaccine distribution is not fair. To date, over 4.5 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, according to data from the University of Oxford. Wealthy countries have consumed the lion's share of vaccines, with more than 4 out of 5 doses given to people living in high and upper middle income countries. Low-income nations have administered less than 0.5% of shots. To further illustrate the wide divide, we can look at the statistics of the United States. The country has administered over 350 million doses. That translates to 106 doses per 100 American. In Africa, that number is around 6 per 100 people. To make matters worse, as some countries have not been able to even kick off their vaccination campaigns, rich nations are considering giving additional jabs to people already fully inoculated. Germany, France, Russia, and the UAE have already started offering booster shots, while the US and the UK have announced or hinted at plans to do so in the near future. This has caused much outrage among activists. Most recently, a group of campaigners slammed Britain for ordering millions of booster jabs, saying the UK is effectively pushing poor countries to the back of the vaccine queue. The World Health Organization has called for a halt on boosters through at least by the end of September. The UN health body urge rich nations to give shots to the poorer countries that are struggling to inoculate even their highly vulnerable populations. But the US almost immediately rejected the plea, saying it has already donated more doses than any other country. That does not seem to have convinced the WHO. On Tuesday, the organization again slammed the existing divides in COVID-19 vaccine distributions as disgraceful and called for a more equitable approach. It said the power to overturn the imbalance lies in the hands of only 20 leaders around the world. The World Health Organization says it wants every country to have vaccinated at least 10% of its population by the end of September. But with the current pace of vaccination drive in the world's underprivileged nations, that goal might be too hard to achieve.
Joining up for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Thea Garajan Sundararaman. He's a global project coordinator for People's Health Movement's Equitable Access to Essential Health Technologies in the context of COVID-19. Also joining us, Gloria Taliani, infectious disease specialist who joins us from Rome. Okay, let me first start with you, Thea Garajan, if I may. The title that I read over here sounds like something that may need a little bit of explanation in the context of our program, because it sounds like, obviously, when we notice the word equitable access in the context of COVID-19, that is applicable to what we're covering today.
So this has been one of the big concerns from the beginning. By the way, you can call me Sundar, just S-U-N-D-A-R.
Okay.
What we are finding, as the statement pointed out, is that the high-income countries, you are having more than 104 doses to 105 doses per 100 people, whereas in Africa, you are having much less, about 6. If you look at the second dose, how many people have given the second dose, what proportion of the population has been covered, it's minuscule in most of the developing world. even in the highest, which would be the Latin American countries like Argentina, Brazil, Cuba, and Costa Rica, would be in the 15 to 19% range, as compared to, say, 62% or 69% for Canada and the UK and France, etc. And if you look at countries like Nigeria, they haven't even reached 1% of full vaccination coverage. Now, that's really shameful, because when this started out, the world leaders promised the vaccines as a global public good. It's far from that today. In fact, it has become one of the most profitable commodities in the market today. And in some senses, the overall policy design seems still more geared towards profit-making than actually reaching out to the health emergency that is ongoing. And that's because largely of the way the multinational corporations dominate the production and supply chains that produce this vaccine, and the way that governments allow them to do.
Uh-huh. Well, Gloria Taliani, let me just quote what the World Health Organization has said. First of all, it's pressing the 20 most powerful world leaders and pharmaceutical chiefs to reverse this disgraceful inequity, as they call it, or inequality that exists in the global access to COVID-19. And it's looking at the 19 countries to avert yet another deadly wave of cases that's happening. And I'm going to use the quote by the WHO chief, which is composed of a statistic. It says, he said, only 1.1%. 1.1% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose due to lack of supplies. Only 1.1% of people in low-income countries. I mean, that's really hard to imagine. Can you please elaborate on that for us?
Well, we have many problems at the same time. The first problem is the inequality, which you quoted. And this is really difficult to accept in an apparently interchanging world. And in spite of the declaration that were performed and done by COVAX project that intended to give all citizens of the world the same opportunity to achieve the full vaccine course. So this is the first problem. The second problem is that in countries where the number of vaccine administration doses have been intermediate and the circulation of the virus is wide, we have a condition which is extremely dangerous, because the pressure of the vaccine is intermediate, let's say, such in India, for instance, where in spite of 500 million doses administered up to date, there is a coverage of doses per 100% people of only 36.7%. It means that the virus circulates in the presence of a low intermediate number of vaccinated people, and the pressure of the selection of new mutants may be dangerous, as it has been demonstrated by the occurrence of the Delta variant. The third problem is that in spite of all the declaration that WHO has done, the COVAX enterprise has done, and so on, if we don't allow low-income countries to make their own vaccine by allowing them to produce it and abolishing the intellectual property, at least for this condition, which is a condition in which if the cure is not given to all, or anyway the protection is not given to all the population in the world, we will never succeed in fighting the virus spread. So the three problems should be examined in a kind of net thinking performed by finding the best solution of the problem.
I see. Well, Mr. Sundar, obviously there's so many questions that need to be asked here, and I'm trying to ask the most important ones before we run out of time. And one of the things that starkly stands out is what was pledged just very recently, the G7 meeting, where you had the world leaders that promised 1 billion COVID vaccine doses for poorer nations. I don't know if you remember, where the Prime Minister of the UK said that countries, he rejected what he called nationalistic approaches. He said already of the 1.5 billion vaccines that have been distributed around the world, I think that people in this country should be very proud that 500 million of them are a result of the actions taken by the UK government. You had the U.S. Prime Minister, the U.S. President Joe Biden that came out pledging some 500 million doses altogether, again, 1 to 1.5 billion doses roughly. Did they fall short, and why did they?
The point is that much of the actions of the developed nations can be understood only in terms of diplomatic action to prevent any weakening of the intellectual property regime. South Africa and India have filed before the World Trade Organization for a complete waiver of the IPR so that you could actually manufacture and transfer technology effectively to the developing world. This has been blocked. And though on paper the U.S. has not approved, has not opposed it, in fact has accepted that it should go on to further negotiations, the European Union has steadily blocked any particular discussion on this issue. So we do need to actually multiply the total number of manufacturers and the total size of manufacturers and the total volume manufactured all much, much more than what is there today. Today what we have is effectively a monopoly by a few companies. Most of them are based in the West. There's only a few exceptions with them in the developing world, and they are also captive within their countries, not able to anyway even provide their commitments to the COVAX. The COVAX itself has been a great disappointment. It was a facility set up internationally to do exactly what you were saying, to provide this 1 billion vaccines that the developing world needed, and a promise to give at least 20% of the vaccines requirement of the least developed countries free. It's not done that. It has failed to raise the money. It has failed to sign agreements with the companies to the required degree. It has failed to dispatch the vaccine. So at some point, all that it has succeeded is to prevent a more vigorous, united, coordinated effort of the developing world to break the bottlenecks and barriers and start their own manufacture on that. So much of the policies is only meant to distract from or break all the barriers against the transfer of technology and intellectual property to the developing world. And that's really a shame, because in the midst of a pandemic, that has affected even the developed countries in a major way. They don't seem to have learned their lesson.
Okay. The intellectual property right, or the patent, Gloria Taliani, obviously needs to be released to countries in order for them to produce it, such as India. But the U.S. has come out and said, you know, we're thinking about that. Joe Biden, this is months ago, and then came out and said, we're probably going to end up giving the patents. But that has not happened yet. It sounds like it's all about money, because the pharmaceuticals are saying, obviously have a say in it, I'm sure. Why is it that the U.S. or countries like the U.S., we could talk about also U.K. perhaps, are not forcing these pharmaceuticals to give out the patent? Is it because of the fact that it's merely about profits?
Probably this is the core of the problem, but it's difficult to imagine new strategies in a new condition such as the pandemic, which is totally unusual for our way of thinking. What is really difficult to understand is that those people do not realize, indeed, that probably pharmaceutical company will lose some money if they allow other companies to make the vaccine by giving the possibility of performing and producing themselves their vaccines. But if they renounce to the intellectual property, probably they will save, all of us will save much more money in terms of human deaths and expenditures for sanity assistance and economical disruption. And this is something we should really measure against the advantage, economical advantage of the
So why aren't they doing that? I'm sorry to jump in here. Why aren't they doing that? And I'd like to continue with your train of thought. I'm going to throw in this particular statistic so then you can continue with what you were saying, where the world economy might suffer $9.2 trillion price tag for failing to vaccinate the world.
Because of an equilibrium of power, let's say, pressure of the pharmaceutical companies probably has more power than any other political and economical pressure over the politics that have the decision in their hands. This is the only explanation, reasonable explanation, because if we count the advantage and the disadvantages of interrupting the intellectual property, it's obvious, it's even trivial to understand that in this condition, allowing other countries to make their own vaccines would be much more convenient.
Well, let's see here, Mr. Sundar. One of the things that is very bothersome, this was a piece of statistic that came out just a couple months ago, and it's about vaccine hoarding. And the particular country that was mentioned here is the United States, fully vaccinated more than a quarter of its population back then, secured 1.2 billion doses, which meant every person in the U.S. received two doses, and double dosing is only required for two of the three currently approved vaccines. And then it says that it could vaccinate its entire population of 330 million and still have more than half a billion surplus vaccines. Can't there be oversight so the hoarding doesn't take place?
There should be, but there is not. And at some point, it is not an easy task to do because they have manufactured it and they keep it. Remember, when you are sort of indicating that the company should give the patent or should give the vaccines to the developing world, that's not how it works. What we have is actually allowing companies in the South to make the vaccines, irrespective of whether these people are giving it or not. The companies in the South are capable of manufacturing. It may not be a new product, but they are capable of manufacturing these vaccines on their own with or without major help. They should just be allowed to do so. It's not a question of... When you're saying giving, you're implying what the process of voluntary licensing. That's good, but not good enough. And anyway, you can see that they have not voluntarily licensed enough manufacturers. So we must actually move to people declaring that, never mind, forget it. You keep your vaccines, you keep your patents. We will manufacture those things because we have a right to do so. The U.S. did it for ciprofloxacin when they had the anthrax outbreak. So the U.S. applies compulsory licensing at will. And why should not a developing country faced with a much larger threat than the anthrax ever was do so? For the HIV drugs, this was done again. So the whole point is there are enough worldwide precedences for applying compulsory licensing. But compulsory licensing today legally is a huge problem. And that is why we are saying to simplify matters, just remove just one resolution in the WTO saying that these IPR TRIPS conditionalities won't apply. Just one line statement will be able to make a huge change in vaccine availability across the world.
Okay.
I'm optimistic about the challenges of domestic manufacture. But eventually, it can be done.
Yes, hopefully that will get done. And that brings me to my final question here, Gloria Taliani. I'm not too sure what type of appeal can be made from this program out to you and to the world. because on an emotional basis, when you take a look at the suffering that the world is going through, we are one of the countries that have been hardest hit in this region. You're looking at other countries in the world severely suffering from these deaths. There's no room for any, everything's at maximum point, it appears. So from an emotional perspective, there needs to be some kind of appeal made to the world leaders where there's some kind of mobilization perhaps. You obviously can expand more on that, where authorities in charge realize the depth of the problem, which I'm sure they do, but to act on it to stop the deaths that are happening. So what would you suggest to move forward from here on?
I think that the most relevant issue is that this is a pandemic, and apparently it doesn't seem to be stopping itself as we wanted, as we expected, as we hoped. So we have to do something really effective to stop it. And starting from organization, and starting also for considering that if we don't solve the problem in a global fashion, we will never solve it in short time. For instance, it would be very useful to use the to employ the vaccines that have only one shot to cover, they can cover the vaccine with only one shot. In some countries, in some conditions, it would be of relevant importance to do that, in spite of having the distribution of the Janssen vaccine only to 38 countries compared to the distribution of AstraZeneca to 176 or Pfizer BioNTech to 107. And this is
okay.
Difficult to understand.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're just fresh out of time. I got to jump in. Thank you very much, though, for your contributions, both Gloria Taliani, infectious disease specialist, and Thea Gairajan, Sundararaman, Global Project Coordinator, People's Health Movement's Equitable Access to Essential Health Technologies.